Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to unpack your sources, give you that shortcut to being well-informed. And today, we're tackling something that feels, well, incredibly relevant. Living in this fractured world, you see it everywhere, don't you? Nation against nation, people against people, different cultures, rich versus poor, even language divides us. Our sources today actually trace this fragmentation way back to an ancient story, the Tower of Babel, a time when humanity was unified, then scattered. So what do the sources tell us about, you know, where this split began? And maybe more importantly, where do they point for a way forward?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. The material really emphasizes battle as this sort of foundational moment. Ambition led to scattering, confusion. But then there's this sharp contrast. It introduces Jesus, who starts gathering people into what our sources call a new fellowship. So our mission really is to dig into the characteristics of this surprising new community. We're drawing mainly from the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verses 35 to 51, and also a recent sermon analyzing that passage.
Right. And understanding this, it's not just like ancient history class. It's really about how identity and purpose and community can be, well, completely reshaped. Even now, it feels like a surprising path to unity when everything feels so divided. So yeah, a perfect deep dive for anyone curious about how these old stories might actually play out. Okay, so let's get into it. This idea of a new fellowship. The first characteristic that jumps out is this call to focus, to shift your gaze. And it starts with John the Baptist. Now, John, he had his own disciples, right? But the text says the very next day he sees Jesus walking by and he just says, "Behold the Lamb of God." That's not just, oh, there he is. It feels like a really profound redirection, telling his own followers where to look. He's not saying go follow. He's saying look.
And that phrase, Lamb of God, is so loaded. It connects directly back to a really powerful story in the book of Numbers. Remember the Israelites grumbling, bitten by fiery serpents. God tells Moses, lift up a bronze serpent, and anyone who just looked at it, well, they lived. The parallel here is pretty clear. Jesus is presented as that Lamb of God, the one taking away the sin of the world. So the sources suggest that focusing your gaze on him is how you find life.
Okay, but here's the twist, right? This refocusing, it costs John the Baptist personally. He basically loses his job, his followers. What does that tell us about this kind of shift?
Well, it's a huge example of humility, isn't it, and purpose. John's whole ministry was about preparing the way, pointing to someone greater. Once Jesus arrives on the scene, John's role is kind of complete. He willingly steps back. His disciples move towards Jesus. It really makes you think, what might we have to let go of or, you know, deprioritize if our focus genuinely shifts like that?
That's, a challenging thought about John. Is there anything else maybe more subtle in the Gospel of John itself that reinforces this idea, you know, keeping the focus off the messenger?
Absolutely. And it's something easy to miss. The author of the Gospel, John the Apostle, he deliberately never names himself directly. He always uses these indirect phrases like the disciple whom Jesus loved.
Yeah.
It's subtle, yeah, but it feels like a very conscious choice, making sure the spotlight stays firmly on Jesus, not on the storyteller.
So bringing this home for you, the listener, think about how often your focus just defaults inwards. We all do it, right? Can you believe what they did to me? Or maybe look at this mess I'm in. What our sources are challenging us to do is, well, take your eyes off yourself. Turn your gaze toward the person, the work of Christ. It's a call for a total reorientation of perspective. Okay, so shifting our gaze is step one. How does that focus then turn into, well, into action? What's the next characteristic this new fellowship shows us?
Right. The next one is about following in a faith. It's about the journey, maybe not just the destination. So Jesus turns, sees these two disciples following him, and his first question is really direct. What are you seeking? It feels like a bit of a test, you know. Jesus often drew crowds, people wanting a show or maybe a handout. He seems to be probing their motives, or they're seeking him or just something from him.
And their answer is fascinating. Rabbi, where are you staying? Now, given the time the text says about the 10th hour, so like 4 p.m., that it implies more than just curiosity, doesn't it? Suggests they want to spend the night to really dwell with him. It's sort of an indirect way of saying, we're seeking you. We want to be with you. And Jesus, he doesn't give them directions, does he? No map. Just come and you will see. How's that different from, say, God telling Abraham, go back in Genesis?
Oh, that's a key distinction the sources highlight. When God told Abraham to go, it was towards a future unseen land, a command pointing away. But Jesus says, come. And the implication is profound. Come with me. His presence is part of the invitation. It brings to mind that name, Emmanuel, meaning God with us. The destination isn't some point on a map you find later. It's discovered during the journey with him. The fellowship actually starts the moment you're with the person, not when you reach someplace. It's all about being with Jesus.
And you see that happen immediately with Andrew, one of those first two. The very first thing he does, finds his brother, Simon Peter, tells him, "We have found the Messiah." And just for clarity, Messiah means the anointed one, the Christ, the one they've been waiting for. What's really striking is Andrew doesn't, like, wait until he has all the answers, right? He hasn't arrived to himself yet.
Exactly. He doesn't say, okay, let me go study for a few years, get my life totally sorted, then I'll let you know. No. He just shares what he's found right away. It's a powerful idea, really. You don't need to have it all figured out. You don't need to feel like you've dealt with all your issues before you can invite someone else to come and see, to join this journey. The gathering, this fellowship, it truly starts the moment you decide to be with Jesus and share that invitation.
That's really freeing, isn't it? Not waiting for perfection. Which leads us right into the third characteristic, flourishing into the future. This idea of a new name, a new identity. Our sources focus on how Andrew brings Simon, and Jesus immediately looks at him and says, "You are Simon, son of John. You shall be called Cephas," which translates to Peter, meaning rock. How significant is that act, renaming someone?
Oh, it's hugely significant. In that culture, names often reflected your past, maybe your family history, or your current situation. Think Simon, maybe hearer. But Jesus gives him a future name. A name reflecting who he will become. Remember, later Jesus says, "Upon this rock I will build my church." So it signals that in this new fellowship, your identity isn't locked into your past mistakes or what people have always called you, or even who you are right now. It's tied to this new potential, this new name given by Jesus. And the sources even connect this to a promise later in the book of Revelation about everyone getting a new name. It's really about becoming who you were ultimately meant to be.
And this new fellowship, this identity, it seems surprisingly welcoming, even of, well, deep skepticism. Like when Philip goes and finds Nathaniel, Nathaniel's first reaction is just blunt disbelief. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? That feels so real, so human, doesn't it? We all have our own Nazareths, those places where people we've kind of written off already.
Absolutely. It's that classic human tendency, right? Prejudging, dismissing something before you've really encountered it. But Philip's response is beautifully simple. Come and see. That's it. It just cuts through the argument. Sometimes, you know, direct experience is just way more powerful than trying to debate someone into belief.
And somehow Nathaniel goes from that deep skepticism straight to belief. How does Jesus manage that turnaround so quickly, according to the sources?
Well, Jesus's response is, again, surprising and very personal. First, he pays Nathaniel this incredible compliment. "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit." It shows Jesus isn't put off by honest doubt. He welcomes it, actually, which contrasts sharply with how we might, you know, push away people who question or struggle. It really underlines that this new fellowship should be a place where it's safe to be unsure, to have objections. And then Jesus reveals something only Nathaniel would know. "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." That moment of supernatural personal insight, it just shatters Nathaniel's doubt. He goes from skeptic to this profound confession. "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel."
Wow. And then Jesus tops it off, promising Nathaniel even greater things. He says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." Now, many of us might have heard of Jacob's ladder. What's the connection the sources are making here?
Yeah, that connection is absolutely foundational. It points directly back to Jacob's dream in Genesis. Angels going up and down a ladder connecting heaven and earth. Jacob was so struck, he named the place Bethel, which means house of God. The big reveal here, according to John's gospel, is that Jesus is the ladder. He is the connection point between heaven and earth. So the house of God, the ultimate destination we're all sort of seeking, isn't a building, it isn't a location, it's a person, it's Jesus himself. It ties everything together, doesn't it? Reinforcing that the whole point of the journey, the true end, is knowing and being with the person of Jesus. So if we just quickly recap this deep dive, this new fellowship gathered right in the middle of a broken world, it seems to be defined by three key things. First, it's about deliberately focusing our gaze, our attention on Christ. Second, it's about following him in faith, understanding that the real destination is found on the journey with him, and that fellowship starts the moment you're with him. And third, it's about flourishing into a new future identity, a new name given by Jesus himself.
Right. And that leaves us with a maybe provocative thought for you to take away. If the ultimate destination isn't a place after all, but a person, well, what does that change about how you think about your own life goals, where you think you're headed? And also, how might really embracing a new name, a future identity defined by potential rather than your past, how might that transform how you see yourself and maybe how you interact with others, especially those wrestling with honest doubts? Perhaps, as Philip said, it's simply time for you to come and see for yourself.